Hi, my name is Kunal, and welcome to the Geeks of the Valley podcast, which connects with some of the brightest minds globally who are leading their respective industries today to discuss the hottest upcoming industry trends and how their work is affecting the global economy. This morning from the New York area, we have the co-founders of Halo Cars joining us. They now head Lyft Media and are the founding partners of Distributed Capital, a syndicate fund. Please welcome Kanan Salah and Faizan Bhatti. Thank you so much for joining us today, guys.
Thank you for having us.
And how are things in light of COVID with you in New York?
Thankfully, in New York, almost everyone's vaccinated. Restaurants are open. I'd say it's 90% back to normal. Theaters are open, clubs are open, bars are open. So thankfully, it's pretty close to normal now.
I'm happy to hear that. And let's jump into the first question here, shall we?
Sounds good.
Tell me about yourself and your background and how it led you to the path of starting Halo Cars.
So yeah, I can jump in first and then Faizan can go second since we have different ones here. So my name's Kenan, like you said. I grew up in Wisconsin to two immigrant children. And then I started Halo actually during college. So I grew up in Wisconsin and went to college at UPenn in Philadelphia. And I studied management, sort of business management and computer science in college. And then I was also very interested in entrepreneurship throughout my undergrad. And during my senior year, I met Faizan and a few others, and we came up with the idea for Halo. The idea really came from, we were looking at how effective online ads had become. So we were talking about Facebook, Google, some of these digital platforms, and how good the ads had become. They're very well targeted. They're very efficient. They're almost scarily accurate. Like, you see ads for things that you were thinking of. And we were comparing that to the outdoor advertising world, in which in Philadelphia, there are taxi cab ads, there are outdoor, there are billboards. And we would see that the outdoor ads were just like living in a different century. There was no technology, no data. They were still sold the same way. They still looked the same way. And we thought that was an opportunity to bring technology and data that was used so successfully in the digital ad world and apply it to the outdoor ad world. So that's how we got started. And we started doing it in 2018, 2019, during college. And we ended up taking that full time, but that's how we got started.
Yeah, and my journey was a little bit different. So I grew up in Pakistan. I spent most of my life there. I immigrated to the United States for college. And after college, was very interested in advertising and the tech space as well. So I joined Google, spent 4 years there in different ad tech capacities. So learned a thing or two about digital advertising, how effective it is, and some of the other things that Kenan mentioned. And then I left Google for business school, where I met Kenan and a couple others. And that's where Halo materialized. And it was just, it felt like a perfect mix of my previous skill sets that I acquired at Google with advertising, and also my interest in entrepreneurship. So we launched Halo while we were at UPenn. And I ended up dropping out of the program a year after. We started gaining some momentum. We moved our office to New York City. And, we just grew exponentially afterwards. And then I know we'll get into this a little bit later, but we ended up getting acquired within a year of our inception. So then we both relocated to San Francisco.
So Kenan, in March 2020, Lyft purchased Halo Cars. What was the process like in getting acquired? Did you have to work with a sell-side advisor? And was there a reason for not disclosing the amount of the acquisition? Tell us more about this.
Yeah, so the acquisition actually happened a few months earlier than March 2020. March is when it was announced. It actually happened in November 2019, which is when the deal was closed and we joined Lyft. And, you know, the conversation started even before that. So it was actually, you know, quite a bit before March. But the process of getting acquired is, I think, in some ways, similar to kind of like a big fundraising process in how it works, in that you talk to investors are buying a portion of your company during a fundraising round. And this is a big company buying the whole company in this. So they're different in some key ways, but there's also some similarities. So there's this sort of beginning stage where you're just talking, then there's kind of like offers, then there's term sheets, then there's negotiation, Then there's due diligence afterwards. So it's a very long process, similar to how, like, you know, Series A or B fundraising could be a very long and pretty grueling process. And we went through all that as well. And I think maybe there might be more questions on some of the specifics on like how to do it well. But it's like 3 months end to end, pretty grueling. It's like pretty all encompassing in that way. We didn't work with any sell side advisor. That was something we just, we handled ourselves. We had obviously our own investors that were part of the process and we used them for advice. We also reached out to other founders who had been through the process. We had some friends and peers who had been started companies and been acquired. So we got advice from them throughout the process, but no actual, we didn't hire someone to do it for us. And in terms of the not disclosing the amount, I think that's common in acquisitions. You know, usually in the paperwork, the company and the both the acquiring company and the acquiree company, they agree to keep it confidential. It's standard for, you know, most companies don't want to reveal more information than they need to, especially acquiring companies. So I would say that that's pretty standard. That's something that Lyft requested for us.
So that being said, what is the most important aspect a founder should take into consideration when negotiating an acquisition deal? I mean, you guys have been through it. So any insight perspective into this?
Yeah, so honestly, there were so many learnings that came through the process. But I would say the most important one probably is just the culture fit. I think not a lot of companies going through the process, especially startups, take that into consideration. But that probably is one of the most important factors in what's going to determine your future life. So you need to make sure that the company that you're getting acquired by, both the company and also the exact rules that you will be doing post-acquisition, would be something that you'd be interested in and will bring you fulfillment and you'll enjoy your day-to-day. Because it is, most of these acquisition agreements, especially the acqui-hires, they do, the founders are required to work at the company for up to 4 years. So, you know, it's a, the monetary aspect is just one part of the equation. The culture fit is just so critical. The people around you, you want to make sure you learn from, they inspire you, and the company that you'll be getting acquired by, it provides you the resources for you to continue the momentum that you had as a startup that made you special in the first place. So I would say that's probably the most important aspect that if I were to look at it again, that I would take a lot into consideration.
So Faizan, I want to dive a bit deeper into this question. When you say culture fit in this sense, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so startups, like larger companies, also have a unique culture, unique chemistry around them, and it can either be their greatest asset or it can be something that prevents them from growing. In our case, Kenan and I often look back at it and try to rethink on how we built the culture that we did, because it wasn't something that we deliberately were trying to work on, but we just ended up having this incredible, very startup-y, very hustly type of culture at our startup house where everybody, we would basically start our days in the morning and everybody would come in with incredible energy. And we were all just kind of solving the same problem. And we all felt very passionate about that. It's easy for that to get diluted in large companies because you have so much other stuff going on. They're just, you know, you might not be the largest priority there. So that's why it's important from the get-go for you to make sure that the energy stays alive post-acquisition as well. And companies are different, right? So there's, even within rideshare, there are very different cultures that you can see from the public eye as well. So you want to make sure that the company that you're getting acquired by is a good culture fit for you. Because if it's not, your employees might not be as satisfied, you as founders might not be as satisfied, and that does reflect in your productivity.
Well said. And since you have been acqui-hired, what have been some of the challenges and wins you guys have faced when integrating with a public company such as Lyft?
Yeah, to Faizan's point, one of the biggest challenges is that the cultures normally of a startup and a big company are dramatically different. I'd say kind of as a rule, startups generally have a very fast moving, risk-taking, highly passionate, highly energized culture where it's like everybody's all in, or you're either in or you're out, basically. Big companies have most big companies have mostly the opposite, actually. It's like very fairly slow moving, fairly calculated and risk averse. You know, you have people with like various levels of commitment. Some people are just there to get a paycheck, some people are on their way out, some people just got there and are excited. So the cultures are incredibly different. I think most startups, when they join a big company, there's a decent amount of culture shock of, you know, like, it's kind of like not everyone here is as excited about this as we are. Not everyone here wants to move as fast as we do. So, and not everyone here is as bought in as we are. So typically that's like the most challenging thing. And that was for us as well. So it took some time to kind of like, even still, when we want to move quickly, it's like we need to grapple with the fact that Lyft typically doesn't move that quickly, or they don't typically like to take that much risk, and we need to come to compromises. Sometimes we're restricted on what we're able to do. Like sometimes, you know, we try to do something and maybe someone like legal says no, that they prevent us from doing it. And we have to kind of deal with that. Like, it's almost like a negotiation at all times, trying to negotiate our culture with Lyft's culture. And that's been the hardest thing to balance. You ideally want to keep, you know, want to preserve the good parts of both. But what can easily happen is that you end up with kind of the worst of both, where it's like you lose the startup culture and you lose like all the hustle that helped you move quickly. But, you know, you also don't get like some of the benefits of the big company, which is like more resources and general credibility. Sometimes that can happen. So you need to be very careful to make sure that you preserve it and it doesn't just like dilute away the way Faizan was talking about.
And I think jumping into this a bit deeper, both of you have been in the driver's seat from day zero, before getting Aqua hired. How has, in your opinion, the process changed pre and post integration?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The process itself, I would say, is somewhat similar. The people, obviously, and the pace has changed a lot. So, for example, the roles that Kinan and I had before the company got acquired, I would say they're for the most part are pretty similar. Where Kinan was a main point contact for all things product. I was a main point contact for all things BD and partnerships. Even after acquisition, that's kind of what our roles ended up being. And the people, however, around us, you know, the folks that we had when we were a startup, obviously they're different from the people that we have at Lyft. And the pace is different. That Kinan also alluded to in the previous question that, you know, startups typically work a lot faster and the stakes are very different compared to large public companies. So there's also more of an approval process in large companies that you have to go through. In startups, you can just think or conceptualize something on day one, and then on day two, just let's launch it. So that part of the process has changed. But the fundamentals, I would say, remain the same, where we're still laser focused on the same things we were focused on before we got acquired. It's just a matter of working with different stakeholders and working, I guess, a little bit slower than what we used to do.
Back in the day, Hilocars had made so many passengers feel more comfortable with some game changer initiatives, like displaying license plates on the Hilocar screens. What are some other unique inventions that have been rolled out before you guys were acquired?
Yeah, I mean, so as we were mentioning before, we were acquired very early in our development. So we were acquired, you know, less than a year in. We had been full time on it for like 3 to 4 months at that point. So we had most of the stuff. We had built our first version of all of our products, like Pickup Assist, which is the product that you're mentioning, showing the license plate, and our hardware, our ad dashboard, our targeting software. We had built our first versions of all of that, and we had roadmaps for what we were going to do. And then we had scaled operationally. We had a fleet. We had started scaling revenue. But we were acquired right when we kind of launched all of our initial versions. So we didn't get to build all the different things. Most of our roadmap got realized after Lyft. So we've been at Lyft now for 2 years, and the stuff that was in our roadmap from kind of day zero or one, a lot of them were realized once we joined Lyft. Like Pickup Assist was the main kind of safety feature we launched pre-acquisition. There's been a few since after we joined Lyft, but that was the only one before.
Now, changing topics a bit, recently you have both jumped into a new venture around investing in startups called Distributed Capital. If I'm not mistaken, it follows like a syndicate-like structure. Can you tell us more about how you came up with this idea, the industry focus, and what your long-term plans are with this new venture?
Yeah, so Distributed Capital came to life because after we got acquired in 2019, Kinan and I were sort of just independently investing in startups. We felt that some of the capital that we got from the acquisition, we wanted to reinvest in other high growth ventures, and we had people around us that were working on those things. So as being an entrepreneur, you end up surrounding yourselves with other entrepreneurs. So we knew other people that were building great companies, and we wanted to be a part of them. And the easiest way for us to do that was just to commit some capital into it. And then we realized as we were doing this, we're investing our small checks into these companies. Others around us, like our friends and family, they were also keen to invest with us. They said, you're already putting your money in. Can you just make it a little bit higher and also include ours? So the syndicate almost was a came to life after that, where we figured out that we're already doing this. We might as well make it a little bit more official and just open it up to a larger audience. So distributed capital, as you mentioned, follows a it's a syndicate. We're industry agnostic. We're stage agnostic for the most part as well. We just invest in companies that we feel very passionate about, founders that we have a lot of conviction in. And we've been around for about 2 months. We've already done three deals that we're very, very excited about. In terms of our long-term plan, Kanam, feel free to add to this if I miss anything, but I feel like it'll always be something that we do on the side. It's something that we always feel passionate about. We already know people that are excited to invest alongside us, and I feel like we'll always have great companies to invest in, but it's not something that we'll pursue full-time. We're both startup operators. That's what we love doing. Investing is fun too, but I think it's just it's a very different stake you're taking. And it's something that's great for us to do, in our free time.
I've noticed that founders really respect when other founders, invest in them. They, know that someone who's investing in them resonates with the pain that they go through, right? When running a startup.
Absolutely. It honestly makes all the difference. When we were also looking for investors for Halo Cars back in the day, it did make a difference. If someone told us they've built a company in the past and exited and all the learnings that came alongside that, they're happy to share those with their companies, their portfolio companies, it's immensely valuable. Because otherwise you have to relearn those things yourself, and having someone by you guiding you through the process is just, it's just immensely helpful.
And if I may ask, what have been some of the major roadblocks you guys have faced when trying to start this syndicate?
Not too many, honestly. This was something like, it was just a natural extension of what we were already doing. So we were already angel investing, and we just started opening it up with more people. We shared the companies we were investing in with other people, and then if they wanted to invest with us, they could. So not a lot of roadblocks. I mean, we've only been doing this for a few months. We set it up and then we did our first deal a few days after, like a week after, and it's been smooth. We've done one deal a month. We run it on AngelList. So in general, there have not been many roadblocks. It's been one of the easier things. That's kind of why investing in startup building are completely different levels of difficulty, excitement, kind of like, investment, personal investment, I mean, a risk you're taking. So investing, I'd say, is pretty easy. It's something that's very passive for us and like it's not hard for us to do, whereas operating is very difficult. So it hasn't, not many roadblocks.
And to wrap up our call with the last and final question for the day, what piece of advice would you give to people out there from the journey you both have had so far in life? You both have such amazing backgrounds. So what has this taught you so far?
So I can go first. For my journey, honestly, I would say one of the consistent themes has been around taking calculated risks. So I moved from Pakistan to the US and I was experimenting a lot with different kinds of jobs and different companies and ended up in the tech world. And when things were getting very comfortable, I chose to leave and pursue business school. And in business school, I chose to drop out to start the company. And every single time I've never looked back and regretted these small calculated risks that I took. So in your early career, one of my main, advice to people out there would be that just take more risks, experiment more, because the more you jump around, the more you'll learn both about yourself and also just hard skills you'll acquire along the way that'll make you a better operator in the future. So even if entrepreneurship is not for you, you'll be a significantly better operator in whatever you're doing if you just try different things out, experiment, and just take a few risks every now and then.
Yeah, and I can add, I mean, so taking risk and sort of exposing yourself to asymmetric opportunities is huge. This is basically what Faizan said, but I think of asymmetric opportunities as opportunities where you have much more to gain than you have to lose. So the idea being that, you know, if you try something and it fails, you lose, let's say you lose, like, you know, I don't know, five something, like 5 years, $5, I don't know, you lose five. But if it works out, you could get 50 or 100. I think you want to expose yourself to as many opportunities like that as possible, because just mathematically and statistically, one of them is likely to work. And if one of them work, this is the power law that is like in venture investing and all over the place, is that you only need one success really to make up for all the ones that didn't work out. And most people don't remember the ones that didn't work out. And I think most people don't do that because there's the biggest thing is kind of like fear of failure, fear of like perceived risk and, you know, not keeping up with their peers. But I'd say all of those are pretty, both of those things are mostly in your head. And if you switch your mindset and you don't compare to peers and you don't kind of like get worried about how others are going to perceive your failures, then you can open yourself up to take more of these. And that's the biggest thing I see. It's very easy right now to live a very comfortable sort of like moderately, or I'd say not even moderately, like successful lifestyle without taking any risk, which is like you go to college, you graduate, go to Google, you work there for, you know, whatever, 50 years, you can just stay there forever and you'll do well, but you'll never have taken any risk and you'll never expose yourself to really huge upside. So, and I see a lot of people that stay like that and they get very comfortable in those positions and then they never try anything that they love or anything with real risk. So I encourage, like, I would say the same thing as Faizan, of like jump into these opportunities, understand that the risk of failing is not as big as you think it is. It's like mostly in your head. Understand that this is kind of a numbers game. Like you need to do a few, be okay with some of the failures. And then I'd say like you're almost mathematically guaranteed for one of them to succeed and to succeed wildly and make up for everything else.
And Kanan and Faizan, for people out there who are interested in catching a cup of coffee with you at some point, maybe after listening to this podcast, what would be the best point of contact?
For me, probably, honestly, my LinkedIn. I check it fairly regularly. So if anyone wants to reach out, they can send me a message there and I'd be happy to meet them.
Yeah, for me, I think probably Twitter is best, at Kinan Avsala, you can find me, or LinkedIn, both are fine. Twitter's probably a little bit better. I check it more often.
It was a pleasure having both of you on Geeks of the Valley, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.